I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 24th of October. Thanks to John Munson for filling in for me. You'll find out why I wasn't here Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, the second hour of our program today. That's all I'll say at this moment. Chris Matthews is our guest this hour. Chris was with us the last time talking about his bestseller, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. He has a new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, and we are delighted to have him with us this hour. He's also author of Hardball, Kennedy and Nixon, Now Let Me Tell You What I Really Think, and American Beyond Our Grandest Notions, the framers of the Constitution, he writes early on in his new book, made two very great offices, one the President of the United States, the other the Speaker of the House. He was a witness with eye and heart, he writes, to one of the most celebrated of these pairings. The time was the 1980s. The President was Ronald Reagan. The Speaker was Thomas P. O'Neill Jr. Both were Irish Americans, and both men were larger than life. And we'll learn about them this hour of the program. We'll welcome phone calls for Chris, who has a lot to say about the times we live in now, too, and perhaps what we can learn from a time when people felt strongly on different sides of an issue and yet talked to each other and avoided filibusters and roadblocks and government shutdowns, etc. For you to join our conversation with Chris, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And we ask you always to go to our Facebook page because it's fun to read all the messages, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Chris Matthews.
Good morning, Kathleen.
So
good
nice.
Afternoon.
Yeah,
afternoon.
Thanks for making time before your show tonight, which I will watch. You know, we talked to you about Kennedy, but I remember, and you write about this in the book some, I don't want to start with either Reagan or Tip. I want to start with you and the Peace Corps. I introduced you back at Alverno College here back in 2007, a long time ago, and we were in sort of a green room, and you introduced me to a person you had served with in the Peace Corps, and I was so impressed that you had stayed friends all of these years. And you talk about your grandmother later in the book, that she had intuited how much your Peace Corps stint in Africa had changed you so much. And I want you to talk about that, and also then the changes that you saw in you as a result of your shining years spent in Tip O'Neill's office. But first, your grandmother. Why is it that those years were so important to you?
Well, my grandmother was, think of Mrs. Doubtfire.
Okay.
Robin Williams.
Oh, yeah.
She was very Irish. She was a Northern Irish orange woman and proud of it. And she was very strong when her husband died, and he was from England, and he had died, my grandpa, in his early 50s, and she had to sort of survive without Social Security, and she lived in Chestnut Hill, a very nice part of Philadelphia, but she had a nice home, too, but she set up a laundry business, and I think all these old Yankee-type or WASP people, the old money people, like the Carstairs liquor family and people like that, they all loved to have Mrs. Matthews do their laundry. So she set up a business, and she ended up getting Social Security and be sending us $10 every time we had a birthday, and became quite self-reliant. Well, when I got back from the Peace Corps after 2 years, and she was trying to figure out how I was making my climb on Capitol Hill, because no one else in the family had ever really left home and tried anything different.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked me in the eyes with that way that older people tend to do, and very seriously and intently looked me in the eye and said, it was Africa, wasn't it? And I'm not sure what she saw, but what I've seen is that the great thing about the Peace Corps, and I've thought about this so many times since I was over there, it's like simulating immigration. It's like trying to get an idea of what's it like to immigrate to another country, like people who come here.
Right.
And they have to learn the language. And if they do really try, they'll really be successful here. If they don't, they won't be that successful. But you have, it's a degree of how hard do you try to learn English. And you're getting used to the whole new thing and looking different in many cases than the people around you. And getting used to the fact you're a minority and that you've got to catch up to everybody else. And the Peace Corps is like that. It's an immigration. It's going into another country for 2 years, which is a long time, and trying to fit in and trying to get something done.
Yeah, well, you speak about it often, and I'm always amazed how many people in public life and public service, good people in public service, have been Peace Corps volunteers.
Yeah, well, we all sort of say hello to each other on that basis, and
right.
The guy who started Netflix, for example, was in Swaziland. I just read about him.
And really?
What an unusual overlap, because not many people are in that little country between South Africa and Mozambique.
Huh.
Anyway, I think that, first of all, being a white person, you're used to being in the majority.
Right.
And when you're over there in Africa, you're not. You're in a very tiny minority. Of course, you have your independence. So you're not hard up. We made about $70 a month, and that was plenty in that economy. So you weren't like a depressed person or anything, and you had status because you were a teacher, and I was teaching business out on the road with my motorbike, bombing around from one small business to another, teaching basic business. But you did get a sense of what it was like to be the minority, and I think, but most importantly, just rubbing shoulders with people for a whole 2 years and really getting comfortable with individual people. And I guess most people, Peace Corps volunteers who've come home would agree with the following sentence. I found myself in a room with 17 guys I'd been working with separately, and all of a sudden I had a meeting with all of them together about something, and they were all a couple, maybe 20 years older than me. And in that room, I knew every personality. I knew them all as individuals, not as black people or Africans and me as American, but as individuals. Mm-hmm. And they pretty much knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what the Peace Corps is about.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful program.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go ahead a little bit. So then you also remark on those years that you spent in the Speaker's office, in Tip O'Neill's office, those intense, shining years. I love that description. That those changed you as well. How so?
Well, it was writing speeches for President Carter was a joy and an easy, lovable job. I was riding around the plane at the end there, writing speeches for a president who's about to give them at the next stop. You were creative. It was a joy to just use words and to try to come up with jokes and stories and some kind of something of literary value and a political purpose. And being a speechwriter, of course, isn't writing down what the guy tells you to write. It's coming up with what he ought to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's what speechwriters do. They come up with it and hope they're right after talking to people and using their intuition and anticipation. But with the speaker, he brought me in. I'm looking at a picture of us now. It's on the back cover of the book. And he brought me in to help beat Reagan. He knew he didn't have the skills for television and the skills to use clever sort of Northeastern language, New York language. And I was kind of confident I could do that. And he needed somebody who would help him take on the big national debate as the last liberal standing. And he told me in the first meeting with his big arms and his big guy, he said, the old dog can learn new tricks. And he wanted to learn from me. And I, as I said in the book, I could have been a plumber coming in to fix his sink or a golf pro to come in and fix his swing. He thought I was the expert to beat all experts. And he put all that weight on me. And and every time I made a mistake, he'd like blame me because if I'm so brilliant, how come I made a mistake? But of course, you do all the time. Things don't work out. You know, somebody attacks us and I made the mistake of letting them in to talk to him and I didn't know they're going to attack us. And you make your best bet. And I always had the confidence, I think, that he would come across really well. Once people got to know him, they'd think he was a guy of good heart and with really the right values, and they'd end up liking him, which they did. He ended up being very popular at the end. But
yeah.
he was squeamish about TV. He didn't think he looked very good. And my view is he looked like Tip O'Neill.
Right.
He looked like what he's supposed to look like.
Right.
He didn't look like Robert Redford.
Yeah, you know? He didn't look like Ronald Reagan.
No, he didn't. And Reagan looked like him. Reagan had all his hair. And
yeah.
He had that ruddy look. I think a lot. When he lost his hair, you could tell he wasn't as good looking. Reagan just looked like an outdoorsy guy who would chop firewood up on weekends. And he didn't look like a golfer. He looked like a cowboy star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so Chip every day would greet you, and even after he retired, what was the phrase? What do you know, Chris?
Well,
what do you know?
You do it phonetically. It's what do you with the D's in it and the Y's in it. What do you know?
What do you
hear? Anything special? Anything I don't know? Where are we at? And I used to ask Ari Weiss, his legislative guy, where are we at, Ari? And with me, it was what do you hear? Anything special? And what he meant by that is you better tell me what I got to know. Don't let me down. Don't let me hear something from somebody else that they're plotting against me in the cloakroom or somebody just took a shot at me. You tell me now. It was a real demand on our ability to keep track of things politically, not just what was on TV, but every whisper in the jungle of politics that might be dangerous to him.
Isn't it funny that you now ask that question of everybody else? What do you know? Really, that's what you're in the
well,
business
I say what I say is, tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, I know you do. You sure do. So you got him to do these press conferences pretty much every day before the House would start its session. That was a good idea, huh?
Well, he always did it, but he never did it with any kind of message. So when I came aboard, for months there, I was working as a communications director for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, brought in to be his secret advisor. It was unofficial. And for a while there, I'd be writing these one-liners, these snappers, and, you know, Beverly Hills budget or whatever it was we could get in the front page. about Reagan. And then gradually after Reagan survived the assassination attempt and the fighting got really close, and his top guy left, he offered me the job, which is really a battlefield promotion, as I said in the book. I mean, all of a sudden, I had gone to Holy Cross. His brother had gone to Holy Cross. I'd obviously been in school up there for 4 years in Massachusetts. I was a Roman Catholic Irish guy. I'd grown up like a little bit like him, a little bit, obviously, much later. I wasn't a New Dealer, and not as liberal as he is, I don't think, in terms of my experience. But he decided to trust me. He said, I like the way you carry yourself, and I'm giving you this big job,
yeah.
And we'll have fun.
Well, you worked really hard. It's obvious that you work really hard all the time. I think that's a good quality in life, isn't it, to work hard?
Well, I don't know. I work hard because I want to.
Right.
And like talking about my book now is a lot more fun than talking about somebody else's book. I mean, Robert Redford, I just mentioned him. He once said the first time in his whole life he liked work is when he was running his own production company and when he was doing something, it was his. And very few people get the opportunity to be creative and then sell your product.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been able to do that. And I guess I do it every night. I'm always out there, you know, I'm trying to develop a calmer, more effective
Chris.
Way. Yeah, I know.
No.
It's never going to happen. But I am a type A, and, you know, but most people I know are, I don't know if you're healthier. This thing about if you retire early, you're healthier or not. I don't know if that's true. I just don't know if the evidence is either way. I've known guys who've dropped dead right around me, my close friends, Tim Russert and Kirk O'Donnell. I dedicated the book to guys just like me, Irish hard drivers, and one day they'll walk across the street basically and they drop. And you don't know whether that's because of the pressure they put on themselves or internally or it's just, you know, the way they were built
mm-hmm.
by God. So, I mean, you just don't know. But I want to write books. Maybe it's that search for immortality we all write books about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why we write books, because they're going to write. As somebody said, if you get run over by a car the next day, that book will be behind you.
Exactly.
You know? But I do think Hardball really started all in 88, and I think so many high schools and colleges that still use it as the outside reading assignment.
Mm.
And I hope the same for this, for this book.
But what does it say in the Torah? You plant a tree, you have a child, and you write a book, and that's a life.
And men can't have kids.
Well, but
women
you've had
can have
children.
Kids, but
well,
I keep thinking that what drives me, because my wife is very happy with her corporate, big executive job, and very happy with our three kids and focused on them, even though they left home. And I still want to produce something, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's fine. Keep doing it. You mentioned the assassination attempt. What a tender moment that was in the book, and set it up for us when Tip O'Neill became the first outsider to see Reagan, who was in much worse shape than everybody thought he was after that assassination attempt.
Yeah, he had lost half his blood internally.
Mm.
He had gotten, thanks to Jerry Parr, the Secret Service agent, he had gotten him to the hospital at George Washington University Hospital in under 3 minutes. It really was a traumatic moment, and he got him in there and saved his life, and the bullet was right near Reagan's heart. Far more devastating a wound than they ever reported at the time. They put out all these nice lines like, honey, I forgot the duck,
right.
And I hope you doctors are all Republicans. I mean, I know what they were doing. You could defend it. I suppose they were trying to keep the world confident that the president was going to make it. And but he was really in bad shape. And they decided to let Tip go in first. It was Jim Baker, apparently, who said the first person to see this president is going to be the opposition leader, the Speaker of the House, and second in line to the presidency. And so he went in, not knowing what to expect, and realized how bad Reagan was. He was this guy he had known as this chipper rival, was now a 70-some-year-old man in terrible shape. And he went over to see him, and I guess he was struck by that. And according to an eyewitness who was there, Max Friedersdorf, who told the story and gave it to me firsthand, he sort of waved to Max, who he knew was head of congressional relations. And he went over and knelt next to Reagan's bed and held his hands, and they recited the 23rd Psalm together.
Mm.
And the Lord is my shepherd. And then he kissed him on the forehead and said, God bless you, or something. It probably didn't last more than a few minutes. I know later Tip felt so uncomfortable. He just couldn't believe he was experiencing this,
mm-hmm.
that he was in such an intimate situation, setting with his opponent, really. And yet his reaction was very Christian, very Catholic even. And, you know, I just think there's a certain – he was a very sacramental guy, Tip. I've been on airplanes with him over the years and helicopter rides. And in fact, one very scary
– Yeah, you're right about
over,
that.
Lake Erie and – right after the Air Florida crash, and I was going, oh, my God, we're going to end up through the ice and never be found again. And,
oh, Chris.
And this 300-pound guy sitting at the very tail end of the plane for maximum leverage, and he's sitting there with that Irish tweed hat on. And I would look at him, and he'd say to me, as I said in the book, what's bothering you? And I said, look out the window. There's snow all over the tires. We're trying to take off for what? For some freshman congressman out in Detroit? Why are we doing this? And he, of course, secretly had said his three-hour fathers and Hail Marys, and he wasn't worried. And that was him. I once wrote a column about that was Tippy. He never showed he was afraid.
Yeah, it's probably not a bad way to live.
Not
you talk about, you know, it's interesting. They were older men, and you talk at some point in the book about the breadth of history that they had lived through, the different era of World War II. They knew the New Deal. Did that make a difference of the horrors of war that they had witnessed, the world wars, in terms of how they viewed
the
world?
Well, they both had physical defects. Reagan, I don't know how hard Tip tried, but Reagan really tried to get into the fighting forces and ended up in Hollywood making movies out there in that special unit. But he really tried to get into action. And just think about it. They were, to them, in their person, they carried the memory of the World War, the Great World War coming, and they saw it coming, and they saw us in it. And that affected. I think there's, as Tom Brokaw wrote, I guess he really deserves credit for this idea of a greatest generation, although what they had is they never complained. My dad never complained. My Uncle George, who was in World War II and liberated one of the camps as a tank commander. My Uncle Bob, who was in Australia as a colonel in the major, I think, wasn't quite colonel, in the Army Air Corps. They never talked about it, and they never complained. And these guys never complained. And I think that's very interesting about Jack Kennedy, too, who I wrote about. They don't whine, and they sort of take it. And Tip's great credit to him was that every day this big, fat guy, overweight guy, had to get up in the morning and knew that at that day he would be confronted with facing down this enormously charismatic leader who had the wind at his back. And Tip was of the old school, out of fashion politically, and yet every day came to work and did his job and never really complained. He just said, let's do it and let's get to it. And he felt the pain. I didn't feel the pain. I knew we were up against it, and it was tough being with him. And he didn't like losing. Every time we got a shot taken at us, it hurt him. But he kept doing it. And when he wrote his biography later on, an autobiography, he talked about how Millie, his wife, had said, if you believe in what you're doing, get out there and do it.
Yeah.
And she was a Dutch uncle in that way. She didn't whine with him or complain. And Reagan, to his credit, in all those years that he was the man in the wilderness, the man on the political right, considered as almost out of it in terms of national politics, he was in great strength by the time he had his opportunity. He had ran for president three times, 68, 76, and 80. And when he finally got it, he was quite ready to take on the challenge.
You put this in a large historical framework in the book, too. For the Constitution to work, you write, the Speaker of the House and the President must be open to the larger picture, to resist base obstructionism, to accommodate differences for the common good. It's a tricky relationship, but for the Constitution to be effective, they simply have to talk to each other. It has to work.
I think that the unwritten part of the Constitution is that we're going to probably, as long as we live, have two political parties. And the American people will continue to use the parties as rotational options. They will say, if the economy isn't so good, we'll try the other party for a while. Or we'll divide it up and keep them honest, and we'll vote. The country will pick a Republican House, a Democratic Senate, a Democratic president. It's going to be some combination. Only in the rarest circumstances have we experienced one party would dictate. LBJ, for a year or so after Kennedy was shot, Roosevelt in the depths of the Great Depression for his first term. The American people are not one party in their thinking. They don't like the idea of one party. So if they're always going to split power, in effect, that means that one party has to either completely run over the other party, which is very rare, or negotiate. And the opposition party has to choose between negotiating a better deal than they would get otherwise, or to just say no. And unfortunately, the tendency lately has been just a big no. And that's how we, and not only that, but basically not really offering an alternative, just saying, well, we'll just stop them. And that was, I mean, I see part of our history, development of a political culture, not just a written constitution. We started with amendments, but think about the culture. I didn't mention this in the book, but think about the culture that included a honeymoon, new presidents were given a half a year, maybe a year, where they'd get their day in court, where they'd be allowed to, the Congress would vote on their proposals and give them the benefit of the doubt. That's gone.
Yeah.
Well, left, I think we lost that sometime in the 80s. I think by the time even Clinton had to really fight for that tax bill of his, and certainly, but W got a bit of that after 9/11, that sense of we're in this together, and certainly going to Afghanistan was a national decision.
And certainly Tip gave that to Ronald Reagan. He gave him a honeymoon, didn't he?
Certainly did. He said, I'm going to give you a vote on a tax cut, the domestic spending cuts, which I despise, and the defense increase all by August 1st of the first year. So basically within 6 or 7 months, everything in the Reagan program had been voted on and approved and was enacted. And you could, but Tip's own interest in that was not just to be, to avoid being called an obstructionist, but he also wanted to put the monkey on Reagan's back. He wanted Reagan to be the president. And so Reagan would have to take responsibility for a declining economy, and he was quite ready to give him that responsibility.
Chris Matthews is our guest. Chris, our lines are filled. As you can imagine, a lot of people want to talk about 2013, but that's okay because Chris is host of Hardball every night on, well, Monday through Friday on MSNBC. His new book is Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. It is already on the New York Times bestseller list, and we're delighted to have Chris with us. I'll give you the number. It's just keep it in your head for a little while. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, you can always leave messages there. I really like Facebook. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. All right, phone calls for Chris Matthews. Mike in Appleton, our first caller. Chris, hi, Mike.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you, Mr. Matthews, for having a wonderful program on TV.
Thank you.
It made me feel like maybe there is a future. my sister, who lives in Weston, of course, when I was a kid or a younger person, I had a great chance to talk to Archibald Cox quite frequently, and I know you know who he is.
Sure.
And I learned a lot, but I'm a very disheartened, pessimistic individual at this point. Because I feel that what is going on in this country is very, very negative. And that if it continues to do, I think that which we grew up as children and our fathers and mothers fought for isn't going to exist. It's going to go away. And we're going to be left to a terrible situation in this country.
Chris.
Well, I think, look, I could go that way, too. But, when I go after the Tea Party people, for example, because I think there's a lot of prejudice there, ethnic prejudice behind a lot of it. And the fact we have a man of kind of an exotic, if you will, background, part American, part his father was from Kenya. He's considered an African-American by his own definition and by the common definition. He's an African-American. And his family is definitely that way. Michelle comes from a traditional African-American background, a rural South, moving north as part of the intermigration. And she's a beautiful woman, and she's an African-American. And we've accepted her as our first lady, 70% of us. I didn't think that would happen in our lifetime, a dramatic acceptance of someone of that background. And I rejoice in it, and I've said I was thrilled by it. And I mean that as a white person. I'm so proud of our white people generally in making that decision that they picked the best guy. I thought he was the best guy. The voters thought he was the best guy, and they made the choice. It's what always makes America great. You put the best basketball player on the floor, regardless of race. You put the best ball player at bat. You do what you can, because America is a country that really does respect, at a pretty basic level, meritocracy. We're not Europe. We're not Japan. We're not Africa. We don't go with who's your grandfather. That's the greatness of our country. And yet there are those people who are left behind in that thinking, and they're there, and they're bitter. They feel that the country's going brown or black or whatever, Hispanic, and you know they're not reacting well to it. And they have the bitterness that they display, and it can be elite people like Donald Trump expressing that attitude. But generally, the great unspoken statement is that America can change, and that America can accept. And with all the yelling and the Ted Cruz sort of snarky, I think negative nihilistic behavior, I think the majority is still accepting of change, and it's a great American country again. It still is.
Thanks very much for the call. I want to talk a little bit more about the very deep, profound political differences between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. There are, I'm sure you've heard this.
Very real.
Very, very real, and so substantial. There are many, I wonder if you agree with this, who would say that Ronald Reagan really began a very profound conservative movement in this country, and in some ways it was just ideas that Tip O'Neill must have thought were quite abhorrent. So how did he deal with firing?
Well, I think there was a difference, and we saw this, Kathleen, in California. And we all talked about this, how Reagan the governor was different than Reagan the commentator. Mm. Signing the first or the big pro-choice measure out there. As president, signing the biggest tax increase in history in 82 after passing the big tax cut. Ending the Cold War, basically being a man, whatever you think of his ideology, was terrified at mutual assured destruction, thought it was totally immoral that we would kill people of another country out of some sort of strategic notion that deterrence would require it. Hated that idea. Even at the time, he was doing things that many on the left thought were zany, like SDI. Star Wars, if you will. Mm-hmm. And all the time, you know, he did have this, it wasn't anti-human. He just didn't, as his son, Ron, again, he just couldn't project the need of a person, say, a young woman who was not going to be able to go to college because her parents had left her with nothing and had died. And he couldn't understand why Social Security survivors benefits or Pell Grants wouldn't be essential to women like that who needed to go to college and didn't have the money. He couldn't project into the larger group the needs of an individual person that he came across. And that was whatever willfulness went behind it, it was there, and it drove Tip O'Neill crazy. And they would have these wonderful fights, where they weren't wonderful, but they were real, where Reagan would say, you know, I hear that the people who are unemployed sign up for unemployment, but the minute they get on the phone and realize there's a job coming their way, they hang up.
Right.
And Tip said, you don't know that. Where'd you get that from? And it would just drive him crazy. And what I don't understand about Reagan is, here's an actor who I know from somebody had come home crying, or got the word with his agent, he was crying, he had lost another part in the early 50s when life was so rough for him, and his wife had walked out on him, partially because of his career failures and her successes, Jane mm-hmm. Wyman. And he knows that people wait for the call or want a job. He knows what it feels like to be wanting to work and not having a job or a part.
Right.
And yet he didn't sympathize. He had this notion, and you get it from rich kids, I know. I just was giving a speech somewhere out in Illinois the other day. Where was this? Oh, this is in Philadelphia. I've been in so many places. Where the kid just stood up at a private school and said, I said, why are you a Republican? He said, and I just opened question. He said, because the poor are getting too much welfare.
Oh,
I mean,
goodness.
I said, wait a minute, how much do they get? He didn't know.
Right.
And I said, where'd you get the idea? He said, Fox. I said, okay, that's what you know. But you really don't know. And sort of human events, Reader's Digest notion of ideology that the president would voice in rooms, even as he would curtail the extreme and radical nature of his ideology as president. He would be both ways.
Hmm.
I do think Tip, and this is where opposition plays an important role in our politics, it tempers the other side. He couldn't be Reagan all the way because of Tip. He basically reached the end of his line in his first year. He couldn't cut any more after that.
Yeah.
And he couldn't touch Social Security because of Tip or Medicare. He wouldn't let him touch it. Every time he touched it, he grabbed the third rail.
And the tax plan didn't work out very well.
No,
he ended up
in TEFRA, the Tax Equity Act of 1982, they went back and basically reversed most of it the second year. And the tax reform bill of 85 was great because even though it lowered the top rate to 28, it did something remarkable. It equalized the tax rate that you pay as a working person with sweat and the equity tax, the way you're taxed for cap gains. First time ever, we said, okay, you make $100,000 a year working as a factory manager. Okay, and if you make $100,000 coupon clipping, same rate, buddy. Hmm. You got to pay the rate.
Yeah.
And today, every time they go back and look at it, they give a lower rate for cap gains. And back then they equalized it. But in favor of the wealthy and the supply siders, they reduced the top rate to 28. Who wouldn't like that? And the way they did it, Tip and Reagan together with Rostenkowski's help and Jim Baker's help at Treasury, they got rid of all the loopholes. I wish we could get back to that. And somebody recently pointed out a couple of years ago, why don't we go back to what they did and go back to that kind of tax system?
Let's go to Keith in Shorewood next. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Kathleen. Sir, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I had a chance to chat with you a little bit out in Charlotte. First off, I want to just say that I think people are really missing something. I dabble a little bit in politics. when you don't get a chance to meet or at least get along somewhat with people on the other side, I think it's really an enriching experience, and it's too bad that we're not having these experiences like we used to. So on to business. You know, we've got the Tea Party. They're very ideologically incalcitrant. They're well funded. They fiercely believe in whatever it is they believe in. So how do you think is the best way to approach this? Through the take no prisoners style of Alan Grayson, or the conciliatory approach that the president seems to have?
Well, start with the idea that they're angry, and they're really angry, and they're legitimate in their anger. They feel that the middle class is being squeezed economically. They think immigration has been too rushed, too heavy of traffic of people coming into the country. These are without the chance to assimilate, just too much cultural change in their communities. We can all understand the normal upset that a person would feel at any of these things, whether it's that cultural change. No society's happy with that necessarily. They can accept it more easily than others, but generally it's a challenge, especially for working people who don't get to change neighborhoods as neighborhoods change. And move to the neighborhood they like to live in. They live where they live, and if it changes, they have to change with it. It can be hard on people. And they can also feel the squeeze that we all feel about our kids. It just seems it's so much tougher for our kids today than it was 20 or 30 mm-hmm. years ago. And it really hurts people's sense of self-esteem, and that's what we're really talking about in politics, your sense of who you are and how different people threaten you. And whether it's a black president, a black first family, Hispanics raising their head politically for the first time, really, in the last election. And it can bother you, the fact that white men are a minority, and you can feel it in your life, and so you rail against it, whether you're Pat Buchanan or you're somebody like Cruz or one of those fellows. And look, it's a reality. The question is, what tactics do you take? Do you try to get elected somebody like yourself who agrees with you, or do you try to derail the train? Do you try to repeal something you don't like the president's health care bill, or do you just try to stop everything and risk everything because you don't like this one program? It's about tactics, and I think animus is normal, anger is normal, but when you start resorting to sabotage as your political method, I think you're going to have a problem with me, and I don't think you should be pointing fingers the way that, for example, Cruz does at people and say he's the next one to be challenged. He's the one that's a traitor. He's appeasing. That language is loaded, and I think there's a lot of McCarthy stuff and things that were in their point to say Chuck Hagel, who's up for Secretary of Defense, a moderate Republican who has served this country in combat, and a guy like Cruz comes along and says, how do we know you didn't take $200,000 from the North Koreans? Well, that's pure McCarthy. And so it's tactics. It's not political argument or even ideology. It's what you're doing in the way you think you can get power. And I think it's really bad what's going on.
Well, and you write about, thanks, Keith, very much for the call. You talk about how both of these gentlemen would work together, would fight with each other, but they would bow to the country's judgment. They honored the voters.
Yeah.
And you get
That's
a sense,
changed.
Don't you get that sense? Nobody cares what people out here in Milwaukee or Wisconsin are thinking about things. And they're just disillusioned, Chris. They're very mad. They're very cut off from the whole political process.
Well, there's a couple of things, the old world things that our parents taught us that I think we ought to remind ourselves of. Respect is one of the respect for office. Tip always respected the President of the United States. He would never say, you lie, or mm-hmm. I can't stand looking at you like somebody's just been accused of saying in the leadership, or I couldn't stand being 10 feet from the guy. There was none of that personal distance, like, I don't want your cooties. Mm-hmm. Like 8-year-olds fighting today. I don't want to touch you. I don't want to be near you. Oh, Charlie Crist of Florida, he hugged the president. Let's get rid of him. Or Chris Christie, he walked the beaches with Obama. Let's get rid of him. This kind of unreasonable tribalism that's gotten into our politics. One thing that the caller mentioned in his preamble there, which I think is really important, was the sense of personal comfort with each other. Like I was talking about being in Africa with all the Africans around me, and personal comfort is a big deal. Ross Dinkowski of Chicago, a real machine politician under Boss Daley, and Bob Freddie, get his name for a minute. Bob, the leader of the House on the Republican side, they would drive 14 hours every weekend to Washington and back, and then two congressmen would be lying on a mattress in the back, and two in the front, one guy keeping the other guy awake, and that's how they saved money for their families. They didn't have a big jet allowance like today, and as a result, they became bonded. Like they talk, I know guys, women always say guys don't talk, but they do after time. They end up talking about the kid they're worried about or a problem where their wife's mad at them about being away so much or they're not home enough with the kids. Or, I mean, those kinds of bonding relationships are really important when you have to discuss tricky business together. And I think a lot of that's lost today.
Yeah,
I really
think you're right. And I think a lot of people have lost senses of humor.
Yeah, and I there's a wonderful scene I saw when I was working for TIP. It was a Thursday night. They just boated, and that's when they, a lot of these guys, the place empties out, and everybody rushes to the airplane. And the Republican guy walked across the floor, and he'd been arguing red-faced with this Democrat. And he walked over to the guy right in front of me at the bottom of the first row there. And I get thrilled. This is my Madison moment, my James Madison moment. He walks over to the guy, and he goes, so what are you doing this weekend? Say hello to your wife for me.
Mm-hmm.
30 seconds mm-hmm. to reestablish the fact they're human beings on this
right.
earth again.
Right.
And although they really disagree, and they'll probably disagree their whole lives, that they're in this together. Now, right, you know, right-wingers or left-wingers don't like to hear me talk like this because it takes some of the edge off their hatreds or whatever.
Yeah.
But they want to hate the other guy, you know? I got real problems with somebody like Dick Cheney, for example, but I'll tell you, I rooted for his health last night. I mean, we've got to draw the line on civilized politics, or we're in trouble.
Yeah.
And we got to draw a line and say, okay, this guy's wrong, wrong, wrong. I don't like what he does, but if he's lying on the ground, I'm going to give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Let's not pretend we wouldn't do that, because we would do it. We would do it. Our worst enemies we would try to save. And the fact is we do are better people than we admit even in these debates. We keep acting like the other side is the villain of the piece when, in fact, they're just 180 with us.
Chris Matthews is our guest this hour. His new book is Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. Brad in Polonia. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. Republicans lionize Reagan. Yet they failed. They forget that he racked up more debt when he left office than I think any president before him. And my question for you is, why doesn't the press point out why we have this debt that we do right now? Why don't they point out that it's because of failed Republican policies, such as their low
tax? What do you mean? What shows do you watch? Who doesn't do this?
Take on debt to bail ourselves out of that in Iraq. Why don't you point that out?
You don't watch me, do you?
I do almost every night.
And you've never heard me go after W on the fact that he vetoed every spending bill, that he racked up the cost of that war. I've been banging his head on that war since the beginning. And I think all liberals and progressive commentators do the same thing. We know Reagan had supply side. We know he had voodoo economics. We know that it didn't add up, and that's why he had to have the big tax increase in 82. We do try to do this, sir, and I don't know how many times we can keep saying it, but you repeating it now, you shouldn't do it as a criticism. You should simply remind us that you've heard this, and you probably heard it on television. And now you criticize us for not saying it. This is where you learned it.
Thanks, Brad, for the call. Nancy in Sheldon. Hello, Nancy.
Hello, Chris.
Hi.
I watch you every night, respect you, and I certainly respect our president. And every president that has ever served, I always respected the office. I didn't agree maybe with some of their decisions, but I respected the office. And I think that it needs more of that being shown in the schools and in the families that this is the United States and we should respect our president.
Well, you know, I agree with you just on that point. I think it's very important, and I know if this sounds partisan, there you go. But I really do think this president made a mistake in allowing the health care bill, the Affordable Care Act, to be called Obamacare. We didn't call it the Truman Plan, the Marshall Plan. We didn't call Johnson's Medicare bill the Johnson Care bill. I think that was a tactical, if not strategic, error on his part. I do think there's a casualness which people say Obama when they should say the president or President
yes,
Obama.
I agree.
I think there's a lot of that casualness that all media is probably guilty of.
Yeah. Thanks, Nancy, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Chris Matthews, host of Hardball, is our guest, and his new book is Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. He's with us this hour. More calls in a moment. Chris Matthews is here now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Before we go back to phone calls, I was interested in the material you used for the book, Chris, the president left extensive diaries, would you say?
Yeah, and they're kind of odd in the sense that they're incredibly useful to historians, anyone who wants to read exactly what Reagan was thinking. He was very disciplined every night, apparently. It looked like he almost every night he wrote down what happened that day, from the family stuff, like who they had dinner with, what kids were home for the time, visiting at the White House, where they're going to go, what the weather was like. And then threw in all the political and stuff, the really important nationals and international. So it was pretty complete. And I think it'd be great if every president did it. I just think it's amazing where everybody says how busy they are. And here's the president of the United States, and he's knocking this stuff out every night and really giving you a sense of history that you would never otherwise have.
Right, yeah. Gary in Washburn, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Gary.
Chris, I'm really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you. I've been a fan of yours for many years.
Thanks.
I think you speak a lot of common sense for some really difficult issues. What I'm wondering is, why did two parties fall into this where there's no longer a loyal opposition? And what can be done to strengthen a more moderate Republican Party?
Well, both parties now, you know, when I was working in politics full time, we had 40 or so Dixiecrats in the Democratic Party who fairly reliably voted hawkish on foreign policy and on fiscal issues, big budget issues, were conservative, but they also believed in Social Security, Medicare, programs like Meals on Wheels. They weren't totally conservative. They were more like sort of pre-New Deal Democrats, or even New Deal Democrats. On the Republican side, I think what happened is the moderate Republicans of the Northeast started getting beaten by the Democrats. And so all those senators we grew up with, there's always a Republican senator or two from every Northeastern state. They start getting knocked off by the Democrats. In the South, the Dixiecrats either changed parties personally or got knocked off by a Dixiecrat who was now a Republican. And so those two reasons changed. Then you take the Rockies out West, where all those liberals like Frank Moss, my first boss, and Frank Church and Metcalf and Magnuson and Montoya and McGee and Tunney. I mean, the whole West was pretty much Democrat up until the 70s, and then the Sagebrush Rebellion came in. So all those seats, all those guys were thrown out. McGovern certainly thrown out, and all those fellows like Frank Church, who were heroes in states like Idaho. It's hard to believe today had Democrats, because the old New Deal projects and reclamation projects and all that federal employment out there didn't stack up to the conservative wave going across that part of the country. So it's all the regions sort of spoke, and they all polarized. And today we have situations like Philadelphia, 85% Democrat. The Bay Area, San Francisco, 85% Democrat. And then the rural areas are almost that much, well, 60% Republican. And then the suburban areas lately about 55 or so Republican. So we only have about 40 or so districts in the country that are swing. And if the Democrats get their act together, they might pick them up. They might get half of them. But I think we have to resign ourselves to polarized political parties like we have in Britain now, a liberal Labor Party and a very, very conservative Republican Party. I don't like it. I really loved it when John Sherman Cooper and Hugh Scott and Bill Scranton and Rockefeller and Javits and Keating and the Northeastern guys like Salt and Stahl. There was a Republican moderate party with Hatfield and people like that, quite capable of taking on the right. And we had a conservative Democratic Party in the South that was very much a part of the party, and we don't have that anymore.
Thanks, Gary. Email coming in from Joe in West Bend. Chris, whose opinion do you respect the most, or who's your favorite guest on your show?
Oh, God. I really respect Howard Feynman's reporting.
I can tell.
No, yeah. Because Howard comes on, he is such a hardworking guy.
Is he?
And he's a humble guy. So he thinks his views, he doesn't think his views are worth much more than anybody else's, but he does respect his reporting. So usually what happens, we'll be on 20 minutes before or less, he'll have just gotten off the phone with somebody, and he will be reporting almost immediately what he just found out. And he often says something like, I just talked to somebody from, and so you're getting great reporting. And I've always been convinced that these programs live or die on nutrition. Unless the show has intellectual nutrition and brings you something that's new to you and important to you, you're not going to watch it. You don't even know why you stopped watching it, but if it's just talk and opinion, you'll eventually stop watching programs. But if it has news and stuff that matters to you and you didn't know and you can share, actually, at the dinner table, you're going to keep watching. So I value him a lot. David Corn, more opinion, but good reporting as well. A man of the left, but solid.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy other personalities on the program, too. Willie Brown's on tonight, one of the, if not the sharpest mind I've ever come across, certainly the sharpest mind I deal with on television.
Mm-hmm.
And the man's pretty old right now, but, boy, his life is coming out of the Texas, you know, the fields there as a sharecropper's family, and then ending up in law school and ending up as Speaker of the House in Sacramento and then as mayor of San Francisco. What a life he's had, and gotten through it clean
mm-hmm.
in big city politics. And, boy, is he sharp. I like guys like that.
Yeah. Stephanie in Madison. Hi.
Hi there. This is an honor. Hi, Chris Matthews. I'm a big fan of yours, too.
Thanks.
And Kathleen, it's just so good to hear you on the radio. But my question is, how much of an effect you guys think, Chris particularly, commercial talk radio has had on this the bad state our politics are in the extreme dehumanization and polarization that we have in politics. And I will say I've been a big listener of liberal talk radio in the past, you know, going back to like the Air America and before. I've cut back because I found I have a little personal theory, just basically it's I don't want to use the word brainwashing, but it's almost like a form of operant conditioning when you've got people who have espoused a lot of the same views that as you have, you know, it's yes, 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 yes. And you get kind of lazy about checking everything out, even especially with people that you really like. And so.
All right. So let's ask, what do you think the effect
is? Well, I think there's one person we're talking about. It's Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh's genius. And boy, is he a powerful broadcaster. Whatever you think about his views, and I don't think much of them sometimes. In fact, a lot of times. He has mastered the idea of being on from 11 o'clock out there to 2 o'clock. He doesn't do drive time. That's really important. If you do drive time radio, you're reaching regular people rushing to work. They've got families. They've got husbands or wives they're keeping in touch with. They're worried about their kids. They're normal people with normal mixes of concerns and mixes of views. But he wants to be on during the daytime. He wants to be on when the traveling salesman's out there. The hardworking guy, usually male, a white guy usually, who's got to get a sales quota met, who's angry generally at the pressure on him and lack of respect he gets and the sales resistance he faces all the time. And that guy is open to his support group mentality. What Rush is a support group. He tells that guy, you're doing everything right. It's the feminazis out there. It's the affirmative action people. It's the minorities who are all getting a free ride. You're the one carrying the load. You're the guy. So he's like a cheerleader for these people, and they need him because they've got tough lives. And he's brilliant. And then the rest of radio is a bunch of imitators of the guy
mm-hmm.
who don't have his talent, certainly not his genius for the audience. And they just mouth it like they've got, you know, talking points. And you read them. They're small-time players. And then there's the real haters out there who are far to the right of Rush who just seem to play, you know, Levin, Savage, the rest of them. Who are just, they have voices which are unpleasant voices to listen to. They're angry. They have an edge, an unpleasant edge. And yet people are so angry they're willing to listen to somebody who's even angrier than they are. And it works. I mean, Ann Coulter, I swear Ann Coulter is a street theater. I think she has her own ingenious tactic. She's an attractive woman to a lot of guys. She shows up on programs. She doesn't have a boss, so she can't be fired, which is brilliant on her part. No matter what she says, it's acceptable because she doesn't work anywhere. At least she makes her own living on books, which I respect. But I think a lot of guys on Wall Street, not the coolest guys in the world, walk around carrying her books like they're carrying a Sten gun. I mean, a machine gun. They want it. It's like racy to read her and be seen reading her. I don't get it, but I think I got it. It's just Ann Coulter's dangerous, and she'll say things I can't say, and therefore I'm going to read her books and feel I'm walking on the wild side. I know I'm getting too social, sexual here, but there's so much to that in this business, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Thank you so much for the call. And we're almost out of time. It must have been for you wonderful to write this book, to spend time again with the gentleman who really opened Washington for you, and you got your political knowledge and fashioned a career and a different career for yourself. But to go back and pay homage to him and to remember those years must have been very satisfying.
I'm sitting here looking right now, Kathleen, at a picture of me Tip's last day in office, really. And I'm sitting over the corner of his ceremonial office, and he's sitting at the desk with nothing to do. My son's about 5 or 6 years old there. I guess he would be 82, 86. 4 years old. He's even younger than that. And he's sitting there watching television with his head on the back of Tip's desk. And he's sitting off to the side in like a split screen watching television. And we're talking, just killing time because it's over. And I'm thinking, you know, I try to go back when I write, and I try to go into rooms I've been in and bring the flashlight of my memory into those rooms and cast it around. Who's there? What's it smell like? What's it like here? And try to go back in time. And it's very hard to do it. You know, it's like Somewhere in Time, the movie. You keep trying to go back. But it's what I try to do in these books, is to try to relive. And I did. And I feel like now I have two more stories to tell in my life. I think I want to tell about growing up Catholic in the early 50s, and the nuns and the disciplines and the punishments and the hiding under our desk during the air raid drills.
Right.
And I want to capture that and being an older boy in an insane asylum. We don't call them that anymore, but that's what I was for a while.
And number two.
And I want to talk about the 60s. And being an African in the Peace Corps with a whole bunch of other people who thought of ourselves as a lost generation.
And, thank you, Chris. Thanks so much
Those
for being
are my
with
goals.
Us. Thank you. You're a fun writer and talker, I might add. Thank you. Chris Matthews, our guest. The book is Tippin' the Gipper, When Politics Worked. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls. News coming up, and we'll return for another hour.